Richard Staymates.
Great, and Rich, I'm talking to you today from where?
You're in Fairfield, I assume.
I am. And you are?
I'm in Colorado Springs.
Great.
Colorado.
Let me just test this and make sure we're getting good recording. Give me one sec. I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk to Michelle and I about your time at the Cultural Arts Center. And I just want to make sure that we have permission to cite this interview as part of that project.
Permission is granted, no problem.
We'll also send you a full copy of the interview and transcript, so you'll have an opportunity before anything's done with it to make any corrections or review what you shared with me today.
Okay.
Great. So, Rich, I just want to start. I sent you a couple of articles I thought you might find interesting that mentioned you from the Bridgeport Post. But I just want to start by asking you about where you grew up. It's an open-ended question, but could you tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up, how you came to be employed by the Cultural Arts Center?
Okay. I grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Left there. My father died when I was 16, and I had been going to a private military high school. And so my last year in school, I went to Montgomery Blair High School in Silver Spring, Maryland. From there, I moved to Florida. And from Florida, I was there for probably less than a year and came up to attend college in the D.C. area. And then from college, I was there about a year. I left college, went back to Florida, and then I moved directly to Buenos Aires, Argentina. And I was there for less than a year, and I came back to Florida and had a boatyard, and I worked for UPI covering South Florida as a photographer, journalist, and I also at that time was building a sailboat, a 39-foot sailboat in Florida. I worked with the judges in Fort Lauderdale as a pretrial investigation, working with youth that had gotten in trouble, and worked with a drug rehab place to help kids and use my business as a place where they would work and I could be with them and see what their things were, and then I would report these things to pre-sentencing, essentially, what I did. And then I would turn these over to the judge, my estimation of how this young person was and how they were doing, and so on and so forth.
This was in Florida?
Yeah, that was in Florida.
About what year was that, Rich, that you were involved in that program?
1970.
And just so we're clear, you went to college in the D.C. area. What school did you attend?
I went to Rockville junior college.
Junior, okay, great. And your major at that time?
Art education and art.
So, and when you were in Buenos Aires, I just want to make sure that I'm following the line here. You were always working as a photographer, or were you, can you just tell me a little bit about what you were doing in those places before you became involved in that program in D.C.?
I met a lady on the beach in Pompano Beach, Florida, who was Argentine. And when I moved up to Maryland, we became engaged. Her father was working at the, he was in the military of Argentina, and he was working with the consulate and the OAS, Organization of American States. He was attached to that. When they left, I think in January of 1968, in February, I followed and went down there.
And you were there approximately...
This is hard to remember all this.
sorry.
I attended a college down there. I audited a class in a place called Escuela de Bellas Artes, and I sought employment. I never succeeded. I find one of the reasons I needed to return to the States. place to live and work as a photographer, journalist, whatever, to cover some of the stories and practice art. So that all took place, and then I got a Dear John letter, so I sold my boat, everything else, and decided I needed to move north. I didn't like having it all one season all year round, so I missed living in the north. So I moved up to Connecticut because I had an aunt who lived up there, and when I got up there, I worked for a boatyard because that's kind of what I was knowing and needed to learn what the area was like. And then I, where did I go? Then I was hired by a corporation to be the captain on a boat that went up and down Long Island Sound, and I would take their guests wherever they wanted to, like usually up to Mystic, Connecticut, and treat them nice and take them back and so on and so forth. During that period of time that I was working as a captain, my next door neighbor to my aunt's home where I was staying had heard of the Cultural Arts Center up in Bridgeport, and she knew my desire to work with kids and youth and liked working with that, and that I was, you know, practicing art and doing some number of pieces and stuff. And she said, you might want to go up and apply. At that time, the Arts Center was still located downtown in an office building. And I walked in there and told them who I was. I talked to Ben Johnson. Bill Collins was there. We chatted for an hour or two, and he said that one of the people that had been working there was going to be taking off the summer, and they had classes and summer camp programs that they wanted to be involved with, and they were looking for somebody who had different kinds of skills, and I certainly did, from photography and so on, that neither one of those two had. Had about the same amount of training and art that they had, and seemed like a good fit. So they took me on. It was a part-time thing. I was still captaining this boat, and usually it was only done on weekends, so I thought this would be, you know, some way I could get my foot in the door and working with this art center.
And that was what year?
Hmm, 1971.
71. Because they were still downtown. Okay, that's perfect.
1970.
Yeah. So you're still captaining the boat and you're working at the Art Center. When did your employment there become full-time?
Wait a second. Let me think about the years. I'm going to give it to you accurately. I think it was 72.
72?
Yeah, 72. That's right.
Okay. I'll be able to follow it in the newspapers and through other sources, so I'll get back to you and let you know for sure. But if you think it's 72, that's great. I'll be able to document it. I don't want you to worry so much about the years.
Okay.
We'll be able to follow that. So you're there. You're still captaining the boat. When did your employment become full-time?
Well, it's when the season ended for the boat. I just talked to him. I said, you know, I'd like to continue on and work full-time at the center because I was really enjoying it, the little bit of time I was kids. And so, yeah, they said, good. And it seemed to be a natural fit. We all respected one another and had felt like it was kind of an exciting thing that we were doing.
Let's talk a little bit about the classes that you taught. And you said that, you know, of course, Bill Collins was there, Ben Johnson was there, but you bought a different skill set. Of course, the art and the painting, but also photography. Can you talk about what classes you taught and how you, you know, what your basic responsibilities were at the Art Center at that point?
I was just, you know, just one of the teachers, and Wendy and Patty were the other teachers there at that initial period of time. And they were, I mean, we did all sorts of, the skills weren't so well assigned. We didn't have a darkroom downtown, so we really didn't do much photography. We shot some pictures and so on, but we had them processed outside of the center at that, on those days. They were getting close to moving to the Gary Crook Center. They were still doing some planning on how this should be laid out. They career, kind of planned out how he wanted the Gary Crook Center. I think that I don't remember when we moved in the Art Center, but it wasn't too long. We had, I was teaching one class. There was a furniture store down on the ground level, and I was teaching them some things about polyester resins and painting some pouring and coloring, how they could do that. And I was doing it without a class being there, but with Ben and Bill, because they were curious to learn some other media. And lo and behold, not knowing that our air handler for our art center directly funneled all the air down into the furniture store.
So what happened with that?
So they became overwhelmed with all these resin smells coming down there, and the fire department came out and discovered that we were the ones responsible for it. We apologized, didn't know, and we certainly didn't do it again. But that.
So, and this is interesting. So you did have an opportunity to help them plan that move to the Gary Crook Center. Can you just talk a little bit about that, to your knowledge, what motivated the move, how they determined that site, and, you know, I know you talked about the dark room in particular. What other things that they were, you and the rest of the staff were excited about, at least in terms of being in that space over the downtown location?
At first they didn't, when I was just part-time there, they didn't discuss anything about it to me. And it was only when they me in that they started expressing that this had been developed, and they had been working on it for 3 or 4 months, as putting their input as to what they would like and how they designed it and so on. And it was getting down to the probably last month or so before the contractors were going to be the finishing touches that they, asked me what I thought about some of the things they knew that I had experience with. And I didn't know where the center was, hadn't visited it, and I don't, I just sort of went by, and I asked them when they were going to start, and they said there had been a couple of delays, so they didn't know themselves when I'd be ready to move. I don't remember that part of it very well anymore.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the type of students who attended the Art Center and, just your experiences, your day-to-day experiences in working with youth there? Just given the people,
of course. It was the same population that we served over at the Gary Crook Center, too. It was just kids in mostly fourth and fifth graders who came there. And they would come in. I think we had three different rooms, but two rooms were generally used there for it. And we had some of the same tables that we transferred over that they would work around. And we just, whatever kind of projects, Wendy was the one who I watched her and saw what she was doing, and then I sort of replicated that plus with my own twist of things and just began getting the kids engaged with different projects, showing them any kind of things from, we didn't have any kiln or anything, so we didn't do clay or things, so everything was pretty much always two-dimensional as far as what we assembled and stuff, or painted or drew, and there was quite a bit to cover just with that. And kids seemed to be always very excited when it came. It was a little strange having it kind of in an office building, but they made it work.
And when, by the time you moved to the Gary Crook Center, how did that experience change?
Well, we were just excited with the space. It was such a huge open area, and we had so many more opportunities. And we had a kiln and a ceramics, and I was very familiar with clay and pottery and building sculptures and clay. I'd done that here and also in Argentina. I worked with a brick making company down in Argentina, so there's a lot of experience with that for me. Bill and Ben did not have, nor Wendy had much experience worked with teaching our staff how to develop and use the darkroom and enlargers and stuff like that, and then they kind of would go on their own. We started all having a lot more three-dimensional kinds of projects. I kind of became the guy who would go around to the companies and would be a scavenger for any kind of things. I went to plastic companies and they gave us lots of scraps of plexiglass and things like that. I guess there were some purse-making factories in Bridgeport, and they did some other things, so they had a lot of scrap leather, so they would give us that. So scrounging was something that I sort of picked up. Ben had been doing some scrounging with Lenny Beaucour and Beaucour Paints, which was a big name in oil and acrylic paints, and Lenny contributed by letting us have dented tubes of paint that we could have with no charge, and that was a huge value in money, and gave us a lot more opportunities to do some more professional.
Now, the center had a budget, but you talked about scrounging. All of you were pretty resourceful in kind of bringing, supplies to the center. What other ways were you? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You were right.
I was just curious. What other ways besides scrounging you were able to get monies? Did you have donations? I remember the first time I ever did a piece of ceramics. It was with you, I distinctly remember that experience. And you were just a phenomenal teacher. Did you have formal training as a teacher, or did you just learn by observing Wendy?
I knew. I mean, I just wanted to see how she was treating the kids and what sort of things she was showing them. I had always been kind of a teacher mode kid when I was very young, and then junior high. One of the things that I had learned a lot was geology. I loved learning about rocks and chemistry and so on. And my my science teacher at the time had me teach. I was in seventh grade, and he had me teach the eighth grade geology class for 2 weeks, and helping the kids get excited about rocks. And I had a tremendous collection that I had collected for years and stuff. And so I brought those in and explained how the rocks were formed. And I had always been involved with science fairs as a kid growing up, and that was something that I just liked doing. And I really enjoyed that experience as a seventh grader, and thought it was so cool to teach my classmates and the eighth grade above me. And I said I wouldn't mind doing this the rest of my life. So I've always had a penchant for it and liked working with young people. So that kind of just came naturally to me. I don't know that I didn't have any specifically form. I mean, I had certainly been a student a long time, and you knew what made a good teacher and you knew what didn't by that time.
You also had a great deal of cultural sensitivity and just a great awareness of the history and culture. Of course, the predominant population by the time you got to Gary Crooks were African-American Latino students. Can you talk a little bit about that and what made you, I just remember your patience and just kind of genuine warmth that you projected in terms of working with those populations. Can you talk a little bit about that and what, you know, inspired you or motivated you in that regard?
Okay. I went to Howell Military School in Howell, Indiana. And it was there for the first time in my life that anybody African-American was in a classroom with me. But not only, well, when I first went there, I went in the middle of the year, and I was put in with somebody, I don't know if I want to say this, I was put in this room of this guy who turned out to be gay, and he began to attack me. I was bigger than him, and I was upset about it, and this is early 60s, so this is really very weird. and I reported it because I didn't want to have my roommate have to be worried about where I was in my room. Well, the roommate was expelled from the school, and when his father found out the real reason why he was expelled, committed suicide, and that shook me quite deeply. I mean, I felt it was just so wrong. I mean, he wasn't a horrible kid. He was just a guy who was attracted to me. I mean, that was it, you know, and in simplest form, and I wasn't accustomed to it. So that was that made me think about people in a different way than I'd ever thought. I mean, I'm a freshman age of high school. But they put me into another room. I got to select my roommate for the next time. They changed every 6 weeks or 2 months or so. And so I got to select another person. And the person that I became a roommate with was African-American. And he's from Chicago. He came from a wealthy, his father was an attorney in Chicago, and he was, you know, pretty affluent and stuff. But the thing that his last name was Mellon, and that's how we knew each other by. He was incredibly witty, and I just began to really, really like him. I mean, he would be attacked with all these racist kind of comments, and he would deflect them and put them in their place in his set, and just a flash. And it was just the courage he had. He wasn't tall enough to legally be ROTC. He was less than 5 foot tall.
Mm-hmm.
And so he couldn't be in that legitimately, but he could tear down anybody in a moment if they presented themselves in a racist form. And I just began to admire him and look at him. And there was an occasion which he had sliced somebody at mess hall and really tore them down. And he was relentless on this guy. And this guy just felt so foolish. Well, he got his other buddies together, and they gave us what they call a blanket party, where we walked into our room and blankets were pulled over us, and they beat us with RM1 rifles and stuff, and let us go. But we were sore and hurt and banged up and stuff. And this is, you know, I've already seen a number of things going on the TV at home with my parents over what was happening race-wise. And I didn't know anybody black, and I didn't know anything then about it, but it disturbed me. I saw the dogs attacking people and Selma and so on, and it just was not something I could understand. Then I equated that with my friend, and it was too hard to believe that was happening to him. So when I went home, I told my mother that I had made a new roommate and I really liked him, and then I told her he was African American. She says, "Don't let your father know." I said, "Why?" She says, "He just would not like it." Said, "Oh my God."
Hmm.
So I didn't tell my father, and I was extremely close to my father. I admired him enormously. He was such a good man, and he had African Americans working for him that he treated respectfully. I just, you know, but he had some issues there about it. We never, as I said, he died when I was 16. I was there at military school, so we never had a chance for me to get his take on everything, but I had not seen him. I knew that he abhorred, like, the John Birch Society and the Ku Klux Klan. He could talk very negatively about them, you know, saying that they were things that shouldn't exist in our society. So, and he had voted for Kennedy, and so there was this weird kind of thing that I didn't know how far he was or what it was, or I didn't even think about qualifying it or understanding it. But so all that took place, and now I then you had to readers, you know, the different things from there that, because I just had never heard of it. There certainly was no Black history epic or thought or anything, and I just felt really, really ignorant about what was going on in the world and felt that I was thrown in this situation for me to educate myself. And that began the impetus, or that was where the seed was planted that I needed to do something. And then my senior year in high school at Montgomery Blair, I became involved with civil rights marches. I would attend the things. I would, you know, got to see Dr. King speak in New York. I attended different things in Washington, D.C. I went to the in 67, there were some riots on Georgia Avenue. I went down and shot some photographs of it and talked to some of the people that are in the periphery of it. You know, they're sort of standing and watching and stuff like that. And they said it was, they thought it would be a good idea if I didn't hang around too long. Whatever I felt, they wouldn't be seen as to what was in my heart as opposed to the color of my skin from the other side. Mm-hmm. And I said, I understood, so, okay. You know, I didn't make myself obvious.
So by the time you get to Bridgeport, because I also remember kind of a distinct feature of your teaching, you would always kind of talk about a little history, a little science. It was you're always kind of endlessly fascinating in that way. Were you just incorporating those things that you had learned and sharing with the students in that way organically, or did you see that as integral to their understanding of art?
Kind of, because it's my experience. I mean, at one time I was thinking of becoming a chemical engineer, so I have some of that aptitude for how things work. And I find that when people do, they have a different appreciation for things that way. That you can just be too simple. I have a daughter who's now 30 years old, and when she was at in grade school, the kids said, you know, and we have the parent-teachers meetings. The teachers would misuse for first grade, second grade, third grade, and the teachers would say, once we had conversations with them, said, your child is so, so different that they incorporate language and effort and just explanations of things in a way that none of the other children do. They don't understand things, and your daughter can talk about psychology, you can talk about hurt feelings, she can talk, you know, and the vocabulary that she had was so much greater than what her contemporaries were. And I said, well, kind of just started talking to her that way from very little, and always read and always explained things in a full sense, and as long as she was paying attention, I was going to talk.
Let's talk a little bit about your colleagues at the Art Center. I know you mentioned Ben Johnson, who hired you or when you came in. Who else stands out in your mind? Who were the people that you worked with, and do you have any distinct memories about them?
Ben was a guy who probably his personality was a thing that got a lot of people because he had a pretty powerful, good reputation in the community from his high school days and so on. And he was sort of known as a leader. So he was really a key element. And his love for art and his enthusiasm for it. And, in a way, he could be a coach with people. And he loved music. I mean, it just seemed like there were so many things that he wanted to explore and achieve and go for. I found that was, an excellent attribute for the position he was in. He had a good presence about him from that standpoint, and he was charming. That was a very effective thing for us to have. on the Art Center and what we were doing. And he was very comfortable in that kind of setting. He seemed to do better sometimes under pressure than he did just on the daily kind of stuff. We didn't try doing very much administrative things. We just seemed to want to explore all sorts of avenues with our art and with kids, the things they wanted to do.
And let's, anyone else stand out? You mentioned a little bit about Wendy and Bill.
Yeah, Patty and Wendy, they were just really good and patient. Wendy would just do all this incredible prep work for the students that are coming in every day. And she would have amazing projects for them. And she was so thorough at every kind of step she would go through to get ready for the kids' classes and stuff. There would be some amazing things that would come out from an hour, hour and a half class, and couldn't have been achieved without her going through a lot of preparatory work for it. She was very particular. She could do the kind of artwork that she does, and I have a painting in my house that she did. Was very meticulous and clean and just had a kind of like an African-American sense to it, just really good stuff. And even recently I've encouraged her that she should go back and do more work on that, of her paintings, and because I think that, like a lot of us, we get diverted from one thing and, you know, do so many other roles in our lives. But I think that I think she just had a really natural gift for design, for coloring, for painting, for patterns, and so on. I just used to get so excited to see whatever sort of thing she was going to work on. So just admired her. And her demeanor with the kids was just a tremendous amount of patience, you know. Quite capable of trying to help everybody, and she had a good sense of humor. You know, I still hear her laugh in my mind. just a good, solid human being. I knew her and, you know, her struggles and the personal things about her, but she never let any of that interrupt her. And she had, you know, some tragic things happen around her life, but she was just solidly good, very wonderful human being.
And you actually, there's a great article in the Bridgeport Post from 1977 talking about the summer camps and how you and Ralph Williams helped the students make instruments out of bottles. Can you talk a little bit about how your work at the Art Center transcended, you know, that art in all of its forms, you know, not just traditional, but also in terms of what you were doing in terms of getting the students to appreciate the ways in which this could influence even making music and other things?
Oh, gosh, I don't even remember that very well. there were so many different avenues. I really kept pushing us to do more and more things because there were a large population of the kids who didn't thrive well in public schools with the traditional systems. But I saw that when they could get into creative things and that they could be exposed to experiences beyond their self-imposed limitations, that they would be so excited that they found something that they enjoyed. It made no difference. I mean, we would make things that, you know, it was just whatever the kids were kind of interested in doing, you could apply the arts to if you wanted to. But I found that the Art Center, while we had an awful lot of kids who came there and did things, it wasn't demanding that they sit there and only do art. They could do other things too, you know, and we could try and engage them and just being in a surroundings that were healthy and exploratory in nature and kind of encourage their enlightenment through fun things. which is kind of a different kind of attitude than you might think of in a traditional art education kind of program. Fortunately, we didn't have any guidelines to say you can't do this, you can't do that. None of that existed at all. So if a kid came in and they were interested in drawing cartoon stuff out of the comic books, which seemed to be very popular in those days, we'd help them and provide them and show them some of the techniques and stuff. And, you came to the Art Center, it wasn't just an art class, it was an experience. And not really well defined as far as the curriculum. It was very, very loose in so many ways. And if somebody came in and they wanted to learn this or that, and it wasn't just the children. We had, I opened up, we kept the center open at night, and we had adult classes. Wendy, on many occasions, was there too. And we got a lot of the senior citizens from PT who would come in, this group of ladies who came over and would start working on things and making all sorts of things, and they would have their conversations back and forth, but they were just so beautiful and so rich in history of things that they remember, in the 40s and even earlier, growing up and so on, that they could relate to one another. So we just, and if we had anybody who was younger who was come over and they could sit there and hear these stories or these ladies work on different, kind of crafts, art, whatever it is they wanted. I don't mean to be so nebulous, but it was kind of getting to know the kids and kind of discovering what it was that sparked their interest was kind of a method. I don't think that we were even all that conscious of it, but we seemed to be. And then if the kids came in and, we were doing our own personal art or things like that, and they wanted to, figure out how to do that or wanted to have something of their own home, then we'd take them and set them aside and just, start working on them. That was true for several of the kids. Leonardo was probably the most successful. Well, definitely was the most successful one in the history of the Art Center.
Now, you mentioned Leonardo. Can you talk a little bit about him or any other students that stood out in your mind?
There was a few. There was a Jose Seaborn. There was a Larry Wojtek, who was a white kid. And there was Leonardo Drew. Were the stellar kids who were very serious in their art. Kind of goofy in some ways, but they were serious about wanting to do art. Larry had first discovered us when we were at the old Art Center. He lived not far from the Art Center, but he would make his way down to the Art Center at all other hours. I don't know how he got there, but because he wanted to continue to draw and paint and stuff like that. And then when we moved to the Art Center, current one, he might have lived much closer. So during the first couple of years or so, we saw him more often. He would come over, and he loved to draw, but he also started doing some sculptures. I can't remember the name of the neighborhood, but they had cut down some trees, and he asked one of the people of the city to allow him to have the top, the bottom part of the tree not to be cut to the ground. Then he did some carvings into that, and that was years around for a while, and then somebody stole it. They cut the bottom base off of it. Take it away.
I actually remember that. And Jose Seaborn, do you know? Were you able to follow any of these people? I know, or Leonardo, Drew.
Once I left, I had quite a bit of trouble not being at the Art Center. Emotionally, I missed it horribly, and I had a long period of serious depression about not being there. And I found that if I kept trying to stay in contact with people, sometimes it hurt. Wendy and Cindy would inform me if somebody had passed away. And then Wendy and Cindy came out here and visited in Colorado. I mean, it just, so it was always hard to be away and know that I would have rather have stayed there in many aspects.
So let's talk about why you left.
Well, I had gotten married, and
that was 77, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I stayed there for another 4 years, but I couldn't get ahead financially. My wife had a job, but it was still not as much fun, and I used to, you know, and while she went along, I used to do a lot of camping trips with the kids, and I used to take them on the weekends. I would go, and we just load up my van, and we'd head off somewhere, and we did, I don't know, many, many camping trips, and eventually some of the other co-workers at the center said, this looks like it might be fun, so they decided they came with us on a camping trip. They had great fun, too, but I had a core group of kids that I kind of worked with. Most of them lived in Building 21 and were close and they're easily available. So we did a lot of trips, including, you know, and then when I did day trips, it was boys and girls. The camping trips, just the boys.
Now, I have to tell you, I remember that van distinctly. And in fact, several people that I talked to, you know, kind of remembered that distinctively about you. I think the first time you took kids trick-or-treating and camping. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it was pretty unique, and it stands out, and just about everyone I talked to has mentioned in some way either being on a camping trip or going trick-or-treating or some cultural excursion with you. And that certainly wasn't part of your job description. So where did that come from? And can you tell me about some of the things that you did other than the camping?
The whole Art Center job was a job of love. It was nothing, you know. It gave me the greatest happiness I've ever had, sustained happiness, in working with these kids. So that was not a job. It was for my own benefit. The Halloween was something that I started out with. I had a Volkswagen van, and I could get, you know, 9 or 10 kids into that. And I lived in Westport, so I thought, you know, let's just take these kids out of. But there was still the fears of, you know, us going trick or treating with poisons, with things. I said it shouldn't happen in Westport, so let's go down there. So I would take. And Westport was a pretty liberal town, and so on. So I said, let's give it a try. So I bought these super wealthy homes, in Westport, and so curious. So they all get out and they go up to these homes that rarely probably ever got trick or treaters and overwhelm the front door. And those people come out and they see all these children, and they are scrambled. I mean, the biggest one that I remember was a man did not have a thing to give them but cash. And so he gave each one of them $5.
Wow.
And those kids came back. They're just like, unbelievable! Most exciting thing that had ever happened to them. And so they went to other people. Some people, I mean, you know, there's had the treats. They were so well received. And they had such a great time on doing that I said, well, we got to do this kind of like every year. And then I got a much bigger van, and I was able to put 27 kids in it. God, would that be illegal today?
I remember sitting in the back of that van on somebody's lap on the way out to West. And Rich, you talked a little bit about you got married in 77. You left the Art Center, I believe, in 81, 82?
81, May of 81.
May of 81. And you went from there to Costa Rica, right?
No, went from there directly to Colorado Springs.
Directly to Colorado Springs. This is, you know, kind of happened after you left, but in keeping in contact with the other staff members, why did the Art Center close?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm not interested in publishing anything, but then started having, I think, some emotional problems. And he didn't have it together, and he wasn't as coherent in his logic as needed to be. Reverend Johnson, William O. Johnson, wrote me a letter in which he asked my advice about what we could do to keep the center going and stuff, and they needed to figure out some directions and stuff. And I wrote quite a long, lengthy, suggestions of what I thought would be best to do, but they probably needed to find another kind of Ben who seemed to be more functional at that time. And I think that it just became worrisome to try and apply for grants. I think that there was a change in the political system of having things like Action for Bridgeport Community Development was waning politically. People weren't seeing the value of it, or the powerful forces on the other side were too strong or overwhelming. I don't know all the final decisions not being right there at hand. I couldn't tell you. It was very sad to see that it wasn't thriving, and Reverend Johnson, he didn't seem to think that there was a lot of hope, too. So I don't know what was happening to all of ABCD at the time. I don't think that we could have operated without having a comptroller and other people who did all the background paper things that took care of the numbers and did all the detail work that's so essential. We weren't, our makeup of all the people on the staff wasn't detail oriented and keeping counts of all that kind of stuff. We knew our success by the radiance of the faces of the children in front of us.
Now, you mentioned Reverend William O. Johnson. Can you talk a little bit about his patronage and also Charles Tisdale?
Charles was there. It was the first one that I was under. He seemed to be a man, in my opinion, I really didn't know him very well, on a real political agenda. He wanted things to happen, but I didn't get the feeling that he cared about the people as much as he cared about himself.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson, on the other point, he did seem to have a lot of compassion for genuine people. He made good bonds. He communicated one-on-one.
And can you describe, I know, but I just want to have you on record as talking about it. Reverend Johnson's role, what was his official role?
Well, he was down in an office. I mean, he would come out occasionally. He had been, but he was at the old ABCD headquarters most of the time. He had been at our place for, off and on for a good period of time. I don't remember what his function was there at Gary Crooks, but... he always seemed to be supportive. He always, he never demanded anything to us directly. I don't know if in private conversations he had said anything to Ben or anything, but I never got any direct feedback. He spoke to us directly as kind of co-equals. He didn't have, like Tisdale was pretty arrogant in the way he talked to anybody. And he didn't listen very well. And that, was discouraging. Tisdale had brought somebody who was from, one of the western, a mayor from one of the western towns in Africa. I can't remember which one it was. Liberia. I think it think it was, with her, and they walked us around, so on and so forth. But Tisdale didn't know any of us. He knew Ben, but none of the names, none of the other people. William Johnson knew all of us and referred to us. And, you know, I mean, it was a night and day between the two. And, you know, and I know that Reverend Johnson had a number of different affairs, as I understand it, outside of his marriage and stuff, and he was quite a scoundrel in that kind of way, but on a one-to-one basis, he was a decent man.
And in terms of... because I know you weren't there when it actually closed, but just kind of a larger takeaway question. How do you think the Bridgeport community benefited or would benefit from the reopening of the creation of an art center? Any community, for that matter, not just Bridgeport, but any community similarly situated?
You know, the arts have always been the remedy for things that have gone wrong throughout society. When the arts blossom and people express, have outlets for it, all of society somehow tags along and improves their plight in life, is enlightened. There's a spiritual connection to each other that isn't held by regular schools. If you can connect to the spiritual dimension of human beings, you release them from this mundane, materialistic kind of pursuit of life daily. There's something, whenever a city is really in trouble and starts to die, you'll find that the thing that resurrects it or brings it back or restores it are bringing in the arts, whether it's performing or plastic arts, or, you know, the visual arts, whatever you want to call it. Those seem to be the thing, the seed, that stimulates all the other things that may come from it. So if Bridgeport, which has had a history of great trouble since the end of World War II, financially and socially inside, somehow or other occasionally had arts in it, but it hasn't been a fervent, sustaining kind of effort. It has to be a program that the people working there don't have to feel like, next grant, will we be able to stay and survive? You know, it has to be something sustaining, something that's built into the curriculum of our lives, or just kind of our general nature. And it needs to be expressed as the spiritual benefit of human beings. That it takes them to a newer plane about themselves. It takes them out of some of the drudgery of life. It's the only thing that will. Mm-hmm. Sports and everything else are wonderful, and they're enthusiastic, but they don't. Other than watching the game of this, they don't have people turn into themselves to look. Explore their own feelings.
Hmm. Oh. Wow. Final question for you, Rich. Is there anything, or what would you like to say about the Art Center that hasn't already been asked, that you feel maybe I didn't cover, that you think is essential for people to know?
I don't. Other than what I just said, I mean, I think that as human beings, we have progressed so enormously in material conditions. The world is, even from the day I left the center to now, I mean, the computer world and everything else is so exploded. There's still kind of that half of society is advanced. But as we've seen in recent years, the kind of social failure of people in their jobs has not been attracted to a remedy. It's still proclaiming the injustices and the anger about that. You really need to plant something that is where love can germinate to transcend all the errors and mistakes and hatred that exist. And I think the Art Center did it for a small circle that the kids that we could really reach, and we couldn't reach them all. It did have an impact, and it did in ways that we didn't perceive at the time. We were having just a good time. There were tremendous amount of love between the staff and what we were accomplishing, but we didn't know that we were accomplishing anything because we were just focusing on, well, let's see, you know, we've got a budget for this much, and we got these kids. Where can we go? What can we do? But I think that in hindsight, it was the love that was there that made it all work. The mechanics, not as relevant as you might expect.
Mm.
Yeah, it had to do with things that were just kind of out of sight of human beings that was there. And I think you need to replicate that kind of experience. The kids came to depend on us, count on us, and we gave all that we could give. You know?
Mm-hmm.
People just have to have the right heart about it. And we seem to have.
Rich, I want to thank you for... it's hard to believe it. We've been talking for over an hour, and it feels like 15 minutes. It's a phenomenal interview. Is there anybody that you can think of that you know? I think Michelle shared with you the names that are on our list. Anybody else that you think we should talk to?
You know, if you can find Larry Wojtek, and if you can buy, you know, Jose Seaborn, I think he had an art gallery somewhere in Pennsylvania for a while. If you could find some of those, you know, and or talk to Leonardo.
Mm-hmm.
And see what his take is. You know, he had me come out and interview me for part of his biography that they're shooting on his life. You know, I think that, you know, some of the students, you know, if we get some of these pictures out there and they can identify themselves or remember whatever it is, I always got a kick out of going around Bridgeport where kids would recognize me or come up and they'd say, you know, you remember that class and that project? I could not remember the class and that project, but I could remember their faces. And they'd say, I still have it on my desk, or has another thing. So it was something that, like, wow, I didn't know. So those kids, if you can find them, they're, you know, I don't even know how you would track them down. Maybe through, if there's any of the records of the schools we worked with, and I don't know. Boy, that's a toughie. I think that once you start getting some exposure about what we're doing out here, you probably find a number of kids who are in their 40s and 50s and who will come out and say, hey, yeah, that was something I did, blah, blah, blah. There was... you know, the kids that I work with, I don't know, were, you know, Terry Brown, he was one of the kids, you know, Dan Gardner, you know, they're around, even Carlton Brown, he lives down in South Carolina now, he's on my Facebook, I had him help me with a mural at a car wash there in Bridgeport. I painted, you know, I had Carlton come and work with me and to do this mural of a tunnel. They put it on the front page of the paper, but I had him be my helper on doing this mural, and he has no art sense at all, and he found me on Facebook, and we've been friends, and he said if I had any pictures to send it, because his daughters could not believe that he ever did anything in art.
That's great.
So I did. I had pictures, and I had his name. It was in the newspaper article and stuff like that, so I sent that to him, and so he could have some proof that he really did do artwork.
That's fantastic. Oh, I think, Rich, that I'm going to, let me pause this. That concludes our, at least the formal part of our interview.